And the farmer got very angry, of course, because he had to stop the harvesting machine. So he put Joe Hill to grease up the axles on some carts. And he said, "For Christ's sake, use your beam, will you, and don't ruin it." Well, Joe Hill says he don't know how it happened, but he forgot to put the nuts on the thing. And as soon as the team started to move away, off came the wheels. In a strike, a lumber strike. They called a strike for some reason or other, food or bedding and so forth. It was apparent the strike was lost. "Well, if they licked us, let's go back to work." "So you guys went to this place, but I'm on strike. You went to work for my boss, and I went to work where you are. We were on strike." And somehow or other, everybody was stupid. They drove big spikes into the trees, so that when the saws went into it, the saw was ruined. Instead of having the trees fall down this way, they had the trees fall down the other way. Finally, the lumber people, "Jesus, we might as well sign a contract with these miserable so-and-so." They just ruin everything you have. In other words, this was the whole philosophy of the IWW. Strike them at the point of production. That was one of their expressions. Direct action. That was another one of their expressions. And Comrade Dunn used one of their expressions the other night. But that's the whole meaning of it. Direct action. None of this finagling around. None of this arbitration. None of this appealing to an impartial arbiter and so forth and so on. None of that nonsense. That's all for the birds. And that's the way the IWW operates all through it. Now, side by side with these great struggles they carried on in the maritime industry, in the wheat fields and the harvest, in the lumber camps, they also carried on a great struggle for free speech. These men were mostly transient workers. They had no home ties. They were on the loose. Now, they were rebels. They were people that had been driven off the farm, some of them, driven off the farms through foreclosures. They were men that moved from the east to the west with the idea of making their fortunes, and they found out that everything was a daydream. They took up the cudgels to fight and to slug their way through. When they wanted to propagandize their ideas to anybody and everybody. So they went into the cities, and they were refused the right to speak because of their radicalism. And this led to great free speech fights conducted by the IWW, which is part of the tradition of the American labor movement down to this day. If a local czar, police chief, laid down the law that no IWW meetings are going to be held in this town, there's going to be none of this preaching of revolution and so forth in this town, the general secretary of the IWW just sent out a notice to the various branches of the IWW saying that starting August 1st, there's going to be a free speech fight in Boston. Everybody is welcome to migrate to Boston and get into it. Well, the boys will pick up their bundles from all over the country, and the first thing you know, August 1st, there's 500 young men and women. There were women, you know, not just men. There were women, too. All come pouring into Boston for the free speech fight. Well, the way they worked it was, 10 would speak a night. They drew lots. That didn't mean they speak. They spoke. They got up on the soapbox, and as soon as they get up on the soapbox, the cops grabbed them and threw them in the wagon. The next guy got up, and before he could open his mouth, he was thrown in the wagon. And that's the way it went. And this went on night after night. So that in some cases, there'd be 500 IWW members in prison, awaiting trial. And you know, in these small towns, say like in those old days, San Diego, Denver, Colorado, Fresno, California, these little towns, you know, 30,000-40,000 population, they can't start supporting 400 or 500 men just idling away their time. So eventually, almost in every case, the Higher authority stepped in and said, hey, fine, Jeff, I can get it. Let that guy speak. Who the hell's going to pay the taxes around here? The public started to squawk about it. So that inevitably, they won every free speech fight. Every single fight. Now, that doesn't mean that they went to prison and they were treated with kid gloves. The most bestial treatment was handed out to these men and women. The most vicious treatment was handed out to these men and women. Just like you read in the newspaper today about these Negro militants being brutally treated by the heroic police. Any 10 of them will beat up a 100-year-old Negro woman. Everybody knows that. They're very courageous. They did the same with the IWW. Clubbed them to death in a free speech fight in San Diego, I believe it was. Or Fresno. Two of them were killed. One of them had his eyes knocked out through the playing of fire hoses on them. When they were in prison in Fresno, California, the news came that Bill Haywood had been found not guilty. And I had a friend of mine, an old wobbly, that was in that fight, and he told me how the jailer came down, the sheriff, whatever the devil you call him, came down and called them all to attention. They were in big pens, you know. And he used real lingo and told him, why, you dirty pack of rah, 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 rah. Haywood has been found not guilty. Well, Obie says as soon as he said that, everybody, woo! And they wouldn't keep quiet, so they called in the hoses to be played on the men. And one of them had his eyes knocked out. Well, these kind of fights were conducted up and down the coast. Not only on the coast, but in some eastern cities, too. And thousands of them went to prison. I might say a little story about one of these particular individuals. It shows the great capacity of these men. There was a man named Walsh, who was a wobbly in Portland, Oregon, and he was quite a showman. And he was a Christ killer, as they call them. The IWW was not a solidified organization. There were 10 and 12 different groupings and factions inside it. There were some that were known as Christ killers, that had a phobia against religion. And this man Walsh was one of them. He was a Christ killer. Then there was an anti-intellectual faction in the IWW that had no use for intellectuals. Then there was another gang called the Decentralizers that was against any kind of centralized authority inside the organization. Oh, there was a million and one factions. Well, this guy Walsh decided in Portland, Oregon, to organize a band. Now, what was the band for? To play some of Joe Hill's songs, like Hold the Fort, for We Are Coming, Bearhead, the preacher, what do you call him? The preacher, pie in the sky, and so forth. No. His idea of organizing a band was to go down and harass the Salvation Army and drive them into silence so the IWW could conduct their meetings. And he dressed the boys up with red coats. They all came down blowing their horns and everything else. And when they had an IWW convention in Chicago, the one that drove DeLeon out, he led his gang on the freights into Chicago, stopping on the way to peddle all kinds of socialist literature, and they lived off the receipts of their literature. The same time, of course, blowing their horn and coming into the convention, singing the IWW songs, emphasizing bummery. Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, which was one of the favorite songs of the IWW. There was another faction in the IWW that refused to work. They refused to work. And my friend O'Brien belonged to that. I don't know if Obie's still alive or not. But to give you an idea of how they felt about this, I'd say 1936 or 7. One fine day, I'm with my two brothers up on Dorchester Avenue, and I looked down the street and I said, hey, I know that guy coming down, that's Obie. He's an IWW. In the middle of the winter, Obie's coming down, he has two horse blankets holding his coat together, straight as an arrow, you know. Here's a guy about 50 years old then, I guess, or 55. And he stopped and we started to talk. He says, what are you doing, Larry? I said, I get a job. job? Yeah. Hmm. Gee. I never thought you'd do that. That was heartbroken. You mean to say you're working and making money for somebody? Well, you couldn't explain to them how you have to work. Just wouldn't work. Never worked. Obie never worked.
No, sir.
He said, there's three parasites that live off capitalism. The priest, the politician, and the bum. I'm not a priest. I'm not a politician. No way. He's proud. He never worked. Now, when these men went into strikes, you know, the Minneapolis strikes that Ray Dunn talked about the other night, to realize the perfection of the organization, you'd have to have an idea of how the IWW ran their strikes. You know, the American Federation of Labor will have a strike today even, or the CIO, they're just as incompetent, because the real founders of the CIO, the builders of the CIO, have all been driven out, of course. And it's been taken over by the stuffed shirts. They have no more conception of how to lead the workers in a strike than the man on the moon. No wonder they're opposed to strikes. They usually show up their incompetence. Now, when the IWW ran a strike, they put out a daily strike paper. They opened up soup kitchens. They rallied the strikers on a 24-hour basis. They organized the whole family of the strikers. Everybody was involved in the strike. They involved the whole population in the strikes. And above everything else, they didn't hesitate to use a little violence if it was necessary, if they could get away with it. They had to use their bean, of course. But when they organized the Lawrence strike, when they were called in to help these poor, exploited textile workers that were working for miserable wages, they immediately put out propaganda in something like 20-odd languages of the workers in Lawrence. In 1938, when I was down there with the textile workers, they put out leaflets and propaganda in 19 languages. But Bill Haywood says they put out literature in 20-some-odd languages. They organized the various language groups and then brought them all together into one solidified whole. They educated them. They talked socialism during the strike. They didn't go underneath the board. Hey, don't anyone know you're a radical, for Christ's sake. They didn't go to church, make believe they were churchgoers. They espoused socialism to the hilltops. They explained why these workers were low paid. They educated them, in other words. And they rallied them into the IWW as members of the IWW. They organized huge defense funds all over the United States to raise money for the strike. After the strike was over and two of the leaders, Joe Etter and Joe Giovannitti, were indicted for the murder of one of the strikers, and then of course found not guilty afterwards, but they raised tens of thousands of dollars for the defense of these men, while the AFL sabotaged everything, and the Socialist Party sabotaged everything. Now this was copied, and these lessons were copied and learnt by the comrades of Minneapolis. Of course, they themselves had been in the IWW, and they knew how to run a strike, so that they put out a newspaper during the strike in Minneapolis. They rallied the entire population. They organized the family of the strikers into the strike itself, so that the whole family was participants and knew what was going on during the strike. And this only solidified and upped the fighting spirit of the men that were on strike themselves. The morale was lifted up. I might give you a little example of a kind of a guy that this guy, St. James John, was, to give you a further idea. Pardon me. In 1906, it was a result of this that he had gone to prison, he organized the gold mines in Goldfield, Nevada. Now, St. John was an industrialist, 100%. So what did he do? The main industry in this town of 30,000, in those days it had 30,000 population, the main industry was mining. Well, since the majority of the miners were members of the Western Federation of Miners, led by St. John, they laid down the law that everybody in the city of Goldfield must belong to the IWW. And the only ones that refused was the Typographical Union. And St. John drove them out of town. The IWW took over the city. It was in this situation that St. John was shot in the arm, in both arms. He couldn't get the guns out fast enough, and he was shot by a scalp. You know, the West, in those days, gun carrying was lawful and so forth. And the IWW, you know. Oh, St. John, the population was 15 to 20,000. But the IWW took over the whole damn town. And the only way that the town was brought back to civilization and everything that we hold sacred and dear to our hearts was the federal troops were sent out to take over the town and drive out the IWW. But St. John and the IWW was the law. And that was the section, that was the place where St. John showed his idea of how to deal with the employers. He said, in this town, the working conditions are set by the union, not by the boss, not through negotiation. The union decides how much we'll sell our labor party for, power for. And the way the boss can find out is to come up to the union bulletin board and find out how much we want next Monday morning. That was it. You didn't negotiate, you just told me, you don't want to pay what we have on the bulletin board there. It's okay, normally be there Monday morning. And he said, the employers had to come to the union hall to find out how much they had to pay. And we might say that 1906, the great fight that St. John conducted in Goldfield was the first victory of the IWW. Now the IWW never grew. The membership fluctuated up and down. The basic cadre of the IWW, the elements that looked upon it as a syndicalist organization, or at least a revolutionary organization, like Ray Dunn and the politicals did, never amounted to more than a few thousand. Yet they organized and led the greatest strikes that took place in the United States from 1905 up to the outbreak of war. Now, when the war broke out in 1914, the IWW took a 100% revolutionary position. Same as that was part of their tradition. They have nothing to do with this war, nothing to do. They called upon the workers to conduct their strikes the same as they did in peacetime. They addressed the workers as wage slaves. And with the outbreak of the war, they conducted even bigger strikes, particularly in the copper mines of New Mexico. And out of this strike came the deportation of hundreds of miners, mainly, of course, IWW, hundreds of members of the IWW to Mexico. That's where my friend O'Brien ended up. And he said they were just picked up and deported across the border, and that was it. And he ended up fighting for Carranza in the Mexican Revolution. Well, he said all the IWW joined the Carranza army. They had to do something to eat. So he said we all joined the Carranza army against the counter-revolution led by Huerta. I have a list of strikes here. It goes up and down. I pointed out how they unionized the lumber camps in the West. And and I might say that the patriotism of the membership of the IWW to the IWW was unlimited. The IWW was their life. That was their life. The same as a member of the Socialist Workers' Party, his or her whole life has got to be centered into the movement. Proud of the movement, proud of the fact that the movement is the great emancipating tool of humanity, and an understanding that there is absolutely nothing else outside of the party that is going to emancipate anybody. and understanding that you might just as well die fighting for yourself as fighting for J.P. Morgan. I think that's far more logical. I don't see anything else. That's what's going to end up. These poor devils over in Vietnam, what the hell are they fighting for? Themselves or for J.P. Morgan and American imperialism? When the war broke out, the government started to take steps against the IWW. The capitalists aren't stupid. They have their political chiefs. They have their brain trust the same as the revolutionary movement has. They know who to trust and whom not to trust. Just as in 1940 they had to crush the Teamsters movement in Minneapolis and the Middle West, so in 1914, 1915 they knew that getting into the war involved the crushing of the IWW, and that's what they did. With the help of the American Federation of Labor, they crushed the IWW through mass arrest. When the war broke out, they raided the IWW headquarters from coast to coast. Hundreds and hundreds of them were beaten up, many of them beaten to death. They were held for mass trials. In Chicago, 115 of them, I believe, or 110, were tried at one time and all sentenced a minimum of 5 years up to 20 years. In Kansas City, or one of the cities in the Midwest in Kansas or Missouri, they rounded up another 45, 50 and rattled off the sentences of 5, 10, and 20 years to them. Up the West Coast, Sacramento, they rounded up and tried tens and tens of them there. And in 1940, when we were running a meeting in Seattle for our comrades that were facing prison, a man attended the meeting and afterwards told us that his name was Edwards and that he had served 20 years in San Quentin prison. And he came to the meeting because he knew Jim Cannon from the old days of the IWW. Now, when they had these kind of trials, the IWW members didn't get up there and plead for mercy or anything of that nature. There were no court records over any of them ever capitulated to the courts. They carried their undying hatred and unyielding hatred of capitalism right into the courts. Obie was telling me one trial that in a free speech fight that he was in. They have the trial, and the judge calls him, or the clerk calls, what's your name? Frederick Engels. What's your name? Karl Marx. So finally they say, oh, Christ, 5 years, 3 months in the rock pile, get rid of them. At the trial of the IWW in Chicago, they had this man, Red Doran, famous agitator and propagandist of the IWW, a street corner speaker, gave a six-hour lecture on economics. And after he gets through talking, what does he say to the judge and to the court? He says, it's customary after all IWW meetings to take up a collection. But we'll dispense with it today. Contempt for the goddamn court. When they're coming out of the courtroom, there was one Negro among those convicted. And when he came out of the courtroom, he makes a smart remark to one of his comrades and says, well, I furnished the color for the trial, huh? And the court officer overheard him, brought him back, and Landis gave him 20 years. Landis was the judge, the famous baseball czar. Handed the guy 20 years, just snap of the finger. This is how they were treated. Now, the IWW branched out, mainly through their maritime fraction. They founded the IWW in Australia, in England, in Scotland, in Sweden, and so forth. When the war broke out, all of these IWWs, all over the world, wherever they were, stood 100% against the war. In Australia, they were indicted and handed all kinds of prison terms. They carried on sabotage and so forth, particularly in the coal mine in Australia. I didn't know there were any there, but according to Bill Haywood, they carried on a terrific campaign in the coal mines of Australia. And they were handed big terms. When the Russian Revolution broke, a section of the IWW, the politicals, the ones that weren't syndicalists, that didn't believe in the ideas of St. John, who recognized that you have to have political action to serve as an educational weapon among the working class, broke away from the IWW and joined the Socialist Party. Now, when you say broke away, they should still be members of the IWW, although in the Socialist Party, they expelled anyone that did belong to the IWW. But these men, I imagine, carried their dual cards, their red cards, as they call it. Membership book in the IWW. Well, they joined the Socialist Party with the idea of cementing and solidifying a body of politicals inside the Socialist Party that were in favor of the Socialist Revolution. In other words, that were Marxists or inclined towards Marxism. And Jim Cannon was one of the leaders that brought a whole group of working class elements out of the IWW into the Socialist Party. I might say workers because the IWW was overwhelmingly workers that in composition. And these elements took a leading part in the fight inside the Socialist Party towards the founding of the communist movement that developed in this country in 1920. However, a large section of the IWW learned nothing from the lessons of the Russian Revolution. The utter necessity of having a political party that could carry on a political struggle against political enemies of the working class. And learning nothing from the Russian Revolution, plus the terrifying campaign against the IWW conducted by the government, the persecution of the ranks of the IWW, both of these combined to wipe out the IWW. And from the time of the, at the end of the war and the founding of the communist movement in this country, we may say that the initiative of radicalism in this country passed from the IWW into the hands of the newly founded Communist Party. This is indeed a very sad event because God knows how many thousands of militant rebels, tried and true, were still captured by the philosophy of syndicalism and stayed with St. John inside the IWW, instead of coming over to the Socialist Revolution and joining the Third International under the leadership of Lenin. They were lost forever. Many of them stayed in prison for 5, 10, and 15 years, and Edwards, as I said, for 20 years. And when they came out of prison, they were all washed up as far as political action was concerned, or any kind of activity. Today, the IWW, and even in the 30s, with the collapse of the American capitalism, the IWW played absolutely no role whatsoever. None whatsoever. It's interesting to think, though, that with the rise of the CIO in this country, the building of the great industrial unions as we know them today, the sit-down strikes and so on, it's interesting to know that the IWW organized a sit-down strike in the General Electric plant in Schenectady way back before the First World War. The first sit-down strike that ever occurred in the United States. And this was evidently picked up by the auto workers and the rubber workers in this country in 1936. But whatever we have today of industrial unionism, we can look back to its predecessor, the great fight conducted by the men and women of the industrial workers of the world. And that great tradition created by the IWW of unrelentless struggle against capitalism and an utmost contempt for capitalism and all its proponents and its ramifications all belong to part of the tradition of the Socialist Workers' Party. No other organization can claim it because we are conducting the struggle on a principled basis and an uncompromising basis and on an American basis the same as the IWW did. That's just about it, Thomas. Any questions or discussion, Thomas?